Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm your host Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 139 on Morella Morphs with Joe Moisiuk, who's at the University of Toronto and the Royal Ontario Museum. Following last episode's theme of having a delayed release because of a surprise oil rig trip, well, this episode too was delayed due to a surprise oil rig trip. Joe and I actually recorded this episode on the same day as the last one, episode 138, and I was super jet-lagged, was recovering from working night shifts offshore. Anyway, I get episode 138 out, but then I was called back to work and back to night shifts pretty much the following day. And following that oil rig trip, I get home and I'm straight into a 9-to-5 job working on a new documentary. So it's been absolutely crazy on the work front, but I'm super thankful for that. But it means that I've only now just gotten around to releasing this episode. So in such circumstances where you're all left waiting for the next PaleoCast episode to drop, I'd recommend looking at the PaleoCast Gaming Network on YouTube, which is produced independently to the podcast and features discussions of past life centered around computer games. But if you prefer your info in podcast form, well, we've got a directory of other shows available on our website where there are almost 50 to choose from. So with that in mind, I've decided to invite these other shows to introduce themselves to you in a Paleo podcast plug. So please check them out and tell them that PaleoCast sent you. And first up is Paleo Bites.
Hey, my name's Matthew Donald. Do you like dinosaurs? Well, of course you don't. What have they ever done for you? Want to learn more about them and other creatures from some fools who derail and ramble about movies and such? Then listen to my podcast, Paleo Bites, where each episode, I and some other folks I've drug along talk about prehistoric animals like Stegosaurus or Beelzebufo and rate them 1 out of 65 million for reasons including sexiness, mana, and dexterity. Paleo Bites, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back to this interview, and it's a really interesting one. We're introduced to Joe's brand new genus, and we get to grips with the anatomy, ecology, and pronunciation of Morella the Morellid Morellomorph. And as always, please make sure you visit our website to see pictures of whatever it is we're talking about. And did you know that you can view past episodes by era or even period? Have a look and see what else was going on in your favorite time in geological history. I hope you enjoy this episode. So hi, Joe. Thank you very much for coming on the show today.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Right. We always like to get to know our interviewees a tiny bit before we start. And so I'd normally, you know, tell them what we're going to talk about in the introduction, but we've started to do some quick fire, non-scripted questions that you are not prepared for. So you're just going to have to go with it. So favorite hobby?
Probably hiking.
Yep. Okay. Favorite modern animal?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. I'm going to go with...
Horseshoe crab.
That's a good one, yes.
Yes, exactly. Jurassic Park, love it or hate it?
Ooh, love it. Love to correct it.
Yeah. Favorite film?
Probably Walking with Dinosaurs, the original.
Oh. What would be your career if you weren't a paleontologist?
I think I once had a career choice website in high school recommend that I become a taxidermist.
Well, you're not too far away. You're working with dead animals, I guess. So,
exactly.
Favorite fossil site?
Oh, I got to go with the Burgess Shale.
Of course you do. Favorite fossil?
I'm going to have to go with the first fossil that I named, which was Cambrorhamstor falcatus.
Ooh, that's the Millennium that's Falcon the, one, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, we'll get onto that in a second. best personal fossil find?
Ooh, let's see. In Ontario, I found a foot-long isotelous trilobite.
Oh,
so
nice.
That's definitely a favorite for me. locally, and then at the Burgess Shale, I found lots of specimens of Cambro raster.
Right. And where have your specimens ended up?
Well, a few of them have ended up in the new Dawn of Life Gallery that's now at the Royal Ontario Museum.
Nice. And then finally, field work or lab work?
Ooh, I do love lab work as well, but field work is just such a special opportunity. Got to go with field work.
So how did you develop an interest in the field of paleontology?
So when I was a kid, I would go down to the various ravines that crisscross Toronto, and I would wander around, pick up rocks, and spot these interesting looking shapes on the rocks. And at the ROM at that time, they were offering these fossil and gem and mineral identification clinics. And so I would go in with my parents. I'd get a chance to meet some of the curatorial staff there, and then they would try and identify whatever you had found. So I would bring in some of these specimens that I found in the ravines and get them identified as these various invertebrates that lived in the Ordovician period in Toronto. And that was really cool. That's kind of what got me interested in the scientific side of paleontology.
Okay, so you're still really early in your academic career. Are the people that you went to take these fossils to now the people that you're working with at the ROM?
So actually, the people who used to run those fossil identification clinics, they're retired. One of them, Janet Waddington, actually passed away just a couple years ago. But Dave Rudkin is the other person who I used to bring fossils to quite a bit. And he's retired, but I still go to him for questions. He knows more about Ontario fossils than anybody.
So despite being that early in your career, you've authored some pretty awesome papers. Like, how many so far? How many species?
So I have 6 papers published so far, and we've named 3 new genera and species from the Burgess Shale, and also this new one that I'm talking about today, which is my first non-Burgess Shale paper.
But you're still a PhD candidate?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm in my 4th year of my PhD now.
That is not bad going, to be honest. Considering that in my PhD, I released 0 papers.
I mean, okay. I had a head start. I like I said, I started volunteering in 2012, so I've been around almost the length of a second PhD at this point.
Okay, and which of your papers is your favorite, or which of your species?
Well, I'm going to have to go back to our publication of Cambro raster falcatus, because that's the first species that I named, and I think you always have to have your first love at the front of mind.
And that was named after the Millennium Falcon.
Yes, we couldn't resist giving it that name. And we called it that because it has this really amazing carapace that covered the animal's head, which we thought looked a lot like the Millennium Falcon.
And did you get any response from Disney or any of the people that made Star Wars to that news when it came out that you've just described that species?
Sadly, no. Genus. Radio
no.
Silence.
Nothing. I would have thought, you know, like at least the t-shirt, at least the tweet or something.
Nope.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, next time, Star Trek.
Exactly.
Like, if anything comes out with like a cube of pyrite on it, you could name it after the Borg or something. I don't know.
You know, I've got a few ideas in the pipeline.
Oh, have you?
I'm thinking maybe some Japanese monster movies next.
Oh, nice.
But we'll see.
Right. The interview that I recorded immediately before this one, which was the one on sloths, I don't know which order I'm going to release them in, but we were talking about naming species before you've found them. Because whenever I go somewhere, I like to think like, oh, if I found a new species here, I could call it whateverensis, or this would be a cool name if this turned out to be a new species. You don't do that.
But I'm doing it the whole time. I'm like, oh, if that is a new one, I could call it so-and-so. That sounds cool. So it's good that you've got a plan. It's good that you have these ambitions and ways to get arthropods, which I think need a lot more love in the public spheres, some press time, some time under the spotlight.
Indeed. Invertebrates need more love.
Mm. Okay, so why the focus on arthropods and the Burgess Shale?
So in terms of the Burgess Shale, one answer is a little bit of serendipity. So because I was born in Toronto and started working at the ROM, it was kind of natural to start working on the Burgess Shale because we have this incredible collection of Burgess Shale material at the ROM. It's now the world's biggest collection from the Burgess Shale. And the curator, Jean-Bernard Caron, at the ROM, who is a specialist in the Burgess Shale, happens to be my supervisor for my PhD. So that's kind of one answer. The other answer, of course, is that the Burgess Shale is just really cool. And it's cool for two main reasons, I think. So one is the age. It's about 506 million years old. And so it's dating back to just after this period in Earth's history, the Cambrian explosion, when we see the first fossil representatives of essentially all of the major animal body plants that are still with us today. And then the second reason that the Burgess Shale is so scientifically significant is the exceptional preservation. And so we have not just the things that we think of typically in terms of the fossil record, like bones and shells and the hard parts of animals, but we also have preservation of all kinds of soft tissues, so eyes, guts, nervous systems, even digestive tracts with the animal's last meals still inside. And so we get this really incredible picture of what life was like at that time that we get from relatively few other sites.
I would argue that it's probably the most famous fossil site in the world. And to be able to just start work and start naming new species and genera from that, just straight off the bat as you're the first thing that you're doing, it's very enviable.
Definitely pulled a lucky straw on that one.
Yeah, so you as you said, you came off the bat of like looking at the local Paleozoic fossils around you. When you went to start working and volunteering at the ROM, had you intended to look at the Burgess Shale, or had you like started to take an interest in dinosaurs? Has it always been invertebrates and always the older things for you?
I think like most kids, I had my dinosaur phase, but what I really liked about invertebrates was that it seemed like there's still so much to be done with them. And I mean, especially looking at Ontario, it's kind of a bit understudied really in terms of its incredible fossil diversity. And so at first I thought working on stuff from Ontario would be fantastic. And then when I got involved with working at the ROM in 2012, it just happened to be the year that my supervisor, Jean-Bernard, had come back from a huge expedition that had uncovered this new Burgess Shale site at Marble Canyon. So we had all kinds of new Burgess material coming in. And so it was kind of natural at that point to transition into working on the Burgess Shale. I don't know if I ever had it as a goal in my mind to work on the Burgess Shale. I always thought that I would never get that chance, but it just kind of came about.
Have you actually managed to get out into the field? Go to the Burgess Shale? Yeah.
So I have been to the Burgess Shale for several summer seasons. We went basically every year from 2014 to 2018 for at least a little bit of time, sometimes spending as much as a month or 6 weeks out there.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
It's amazing. And, you know, that's why I said I like field work the best. It's just an awesome place to do field work. It's so beautiful. We get to camp there right in the parks, right next to the sites, do hiking every day and collect these incredible fossils.
Because I know that you can go and visit as a tourist, but if you find the fossil, you can't take it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So there's three sites that are now available for tours from Parks Canada. And so you can hike up to those and take a look at some of the specimens that are still lying around, and they have some special samples that they'll show you from their little lock boxes as well. But when we go with the ROM expeditions, we're able to collect the specimens and bring them back to the ROMs with special permits from Parks Canada.
I just could not go and see some of these amazing fossils and then just at the end of the day just be like, see ya, you just wait here for hopefully some scientist from the ROM will come and pick you up. Or, I mean, for something like Morella, where there's so many specimens, like, would you even bother picking that up on one of your expeditions out? Do you just chuck them in a pile? And
I mean, it's not possible for us to collect every single specimen of some of these really abundant animals simply because we don't have the storage space at the ROM. But we do try to collect everything that we think could be scientifically relevant. So most of the material does end up getting collected. And what doesn't get collected remains there. And, you know, hopefully when the public comes to see the site, they're actually able to see some of the fossils right at the site, which I think is kind of nice.
There's a storage space at my house. I'll have you know. Right. So anyway, talking about Morella, this interview is going to be on Morella morphs. And so let's first talk about Morella and its significance. So can you give us an introduction to this genus?
Sure. So Morella is one of the most common animals that we find at the Burgess Shale. It's also one of the first animals that was discovered there by Charles Walcott back in 1909. And so it's featured in some of his early drawings and notebooks from the site. And initially, this animal was nicknamed the lace crab, but its final name that it's been given is named after a Cambridge University paleontologist for the genus epithet and the Latin word for beautiful or brilliant for the specific epithet. And so it's this really nice looking small creature. It's about 1 or 2 centimeters long, typically, with this very elaborate, ornate looking head shield with these long horn-like spines coming off of it. And then it has a body that looks a little bit like a trilobite. So it has this long pair of sensory antennae at the front. It has a pair of these oar-like limbs behind those that we think it would have used to propel itself through the water. And it then has a series of two-branched limbs under its body, under its trunk, that look a little bit like trilobite limbs. So they have like a walking branch and a swimming branch or a gill branch that looks a little bit like a feather. And another thing to add about their morphology is that Morella is a blind animal, so it doesn't appear to have any eyes at all. So that's a bit unusual for Burgess animals.
So during my undergrad and in my paleo lessons in which we looked at the Burgess Shale, we were introduced to it as kind of like a naked trilobite. Like, how accurate is that? And how closely related was Morella and the Morella morphs to trilobites?
So I guess one of the main differences in appearance between Morella and your typical trilobite is that the trilobites get their name from that three-lobed appearance to their body. So they have that middle section, which has these sort of half-ring-like segments. And then you have lateral sections on either side, which sort of project out to the side. So you get this three-part structure across the width of the body of the trilobite. So with Morella, you can sort of imagine that those two lateral sections that are sticking out from the sides are just gone. So it has these sort of short ring-like segments dorsally along the body, but there's nothing projecting laterally from the body. So I guess that's where that naked idea comes from. In terms of the relationship of Morella to the trilobites, I think that is an area where we still have a lot of controversy. Originally, Morella was viewed as a trilobitomorph, so a member of this group of trilobite-like animals that we see, especially in the Cambrian period, that have very diverse different forms. But there are some different hypotheses that maybe we'll go into a bit later in terms of how close it actually is to the trilobites.
Okay. And so you told us what it looks like. What were its spines for? This elaborate, ornate head shield that had all these spines. What were its oar-like appendages for? Do we know much about its ecology, how it lived, what it was doing?
So I think those oar-like appendages are pretty similar to things that we see in some aquatic insects, for example. They have these broadened segments with little hairs or little setae along the margins. And so they really look like structures that modern insects, aquatic insects, for example, use to swim. In terms of the spines, I think we're a lot less clear on what those spines were doing in the animal. We see a lot of spiny ornamentation on different animals in the Cambrian period, and I think the default assumption is often that spines are for defense against predators. But I think that's not such a clear-cut case with Morella and with the Morella morphs in general, because some of these things, including our new genus Tomlinsonis, have these incredibly ornate spines that have these finger-like outgrowths all along their margins. And so these things don't really look like defensive structures. And there's an interesting observation that was made on some Devonian Morella morphs from Germany, where it was found that they have little bits of sponge and sponge spicules actually stuck to the top of the spines. And so I think the idea is that they may have been sort of camouflaging themselves in a way that might be similar to, say, like modern assassin bugs that will take stuff from their environment and sort of pack it onto their backs for camouflage.
That would be super cool. So they have spines on their spines and they stick bits into that, but then they're swimming around. So if you see a clump of the seafloor swimming around in the water, that might be a Morella morph. Okay, so was it a paleo-ecologically significant group? And what kinds of evidence do we have to support or unsupport that? Or not support that?
So I think Morella is one of the most abundant animals at the Burgess Shale, like I mentioned. And in fact, at the Walcott Quarry, which is sort of the classic locality of the Burgess Shale, it represents about 7% of all of the organisms found there. And so that's a pretty huge number of those guys that were living in that environment. You know, tens of thousands of specimens have been collected. So I think it's pretty clear that at the Burgess Shale, Morella was quite important. It's important for us in terms of understanding ecology at the Burgess Shale as well, because we have so much abundance of this animal that we see it in all of its different life modes from or developmental modes, from like small juveniles up to adults. We see examples of it caught mid-molt. So while it's molting its exoskeleton, one of the few examples that we know of in the fossil record of an arthropod trapped as it was molting. Outside of the Burgess Shale, Morella morphs are very rare. We only have about a dozen different Morella morph species from across about 100 million year time range for the group. And so I think it's hard to say whether Morella morphs were really very important ecologically outside of the Burgess Shale.
Is it that they weren't that important outside of the Burgess Shale, or that the Burgess Shale just does such a good job of capturing their fossil record?
Yeah, I think it's probably a little bit of both, a little bit preservation and a little bit biology. So for example, just comparing different sites in the Cambrian, Morella is super abundant at the Burgess Shale, but there aren't very many specimens of Morella from any of the different Cambrian Lagerstätten in China. So I think that seems like a pretty clear ecological signal. But once we get into the post-Cambrian especially, I think there's a pretty strong preservational bias that we're dealing with. It seems pretty clear that the big gaps in Morellimore fossil record also coincide with gaps in the sorts of Lagerstätten that we would expect to see them preserved in.
And of the species that we do know, you said there were only about a dozen or something. Is there much variety in those? Are they all pretty much Morella-looking things, or do they get pretty daft, crazy, wacky?
So I would say that there's basically two main groups of Morellimorphs, which are pretty conservative within those groups, but quite divergent from each other. So one of those groups is called the Morellids, and that includes Morella and other organisms that look like it. So they're all characterized by that really spiny, ornate head shield. And then you have another group of Morellimorphs called the Acercostrakens. And these guys have a body that essentially looks like Morella, but then they have this crazy large ovate carapace that sort of covers the entire backside of the animal.
So Morella is a Morellid, which is a Morellimorph.
Yes.
Okay. It gets confusing, you can see, with these larger and larger groups. We don't get very inventive as paleontologists with the names of our groups, just naming them after the most charismatic or the first organism in that group. So I worked on Chasmataspidids. So we had a species, genus Chasmataspis, which was a family of the Chasmataspididae, which was part of the order Chasmataspida. Yeah, it got ridiculously confusing. But yes, Morella is a Morellid, which is a Morellimorph.
Exactly.
And Morellimorphs are trilobitomorphs.
Potentially, yes.
Potentially. And so is that their closest relative, the trilobites, or are there other things that are more like Morellimorphs than trilobites?
So Morellimorphs have been, I would say, one of the more controversial groups of arthropods in terms of placing them on the tree. So initially, it was thought that they were closely related to trilobites because they sort of have this general trilobite-like body plan with, you know, a head and a trunk region and these appendages on the trunk that are very trilobite-like. There have been some more recent suggestions that Morellimorphs might actually be more closely related to crustaceans or to mandibulate arthropods, so the modern group that includes crustaceans and insects and millipedes. And that's based on a few characteristics, like, for example, those half ring-shaped segments on the trunk that I mentioned earlier, which are much more similar to things that we typically see in mandibulate arthropods than in trilobites and their relatives.
Okay, and when did they go extinct?
So the last known Morellimorphs that we're aware of come from the Devonian of Germany. And so it's possible that they went extinct in the mid-Devonian extinction event. But because their distribution is so dependent on the presence of these Lagerstätten that preserve just the right sorts of environments, it's also possible that Morellimorphs survived longer than that and have sort of a cryptic history into the later part of the Paleozoic.
Right, so the reason we're doing this interview is because you recently described a new Morellimorph from what's been dubbed the Brecken Lagerstätte, or site of special preservation. So can you tell us about this site? Where is it? How old is it? What are all its important details that we need to know about?
So Brecken is a really cool Ordovician fossil site. So it's about 450 million years old. It comes from the region around Lake Simcoe in southern Ontario. And so it's a little bit north of Toronto. And what makes it really interesting is that it preserves these incredible communities of invertebrate organisms buried in place by storm deposits on this shallow open marine shelf that would have covered North America during that time period.
So it's a little younger than the Burgess Shale.
That's right.
Does that age matter that much?
Yeah, so the Burgess Shale is one of a suite of these sites of exceptional preservation, these Lagerstätten, which we find from the Cambrian times in particular. And so they seem to be especially abundant around the world during the Cambrian. But then into the Ordovician, we see fewer and fewer of these sorts of sites of soft tissue preservation coming from these relatively open marine environments. And so in the Ordovician, we have more Lagerstätten representing environments that are a bit weirder. So things like these very shallow, hypersaline inland lagoonal areas, or very, very deep water environments that were probably low in oxygen. And so we sort of start to cut out this major part of the environment, these shallow marine shelves, as we go into the Ordovician. And we have relatively few sites that show us what the soft-bodied organisms that were living in those environments would have looked like. And so I think that the findings at Brecon are really interesting in that respect, because they help to fill in that gap in time and in the environments that we know these soft-bodied organisms from.
So if we were to teleport ourselves back into the Ordovician and visit what's now Brecon, what would it be like? What would the environment be like? Would it be hot or cold? Where are we in the world? Are we close to the equator or not? What's it like there?
Yeah, so it would have been a fairly shallow tropical ocean. So we're talking about waters that were close to the equator in the Ordovician period. And probably based on the sedimentology of the area, we would estimate a few tens of meters of water in the area where these animals were living. It's a very shallow but open water area, so we're far from any land masses except maybe a few small islands. And we have these extensive reefs that have formed all across this shallow continental shelf. And what's kind of interesting about the Brecon site is that we have the formation of these bottom surfaces called hard grounds, where essentially the bottom gets mineralized rapidly and then exhumed by erosion. And so you get this really complex hard ground surface, which is covered in all of these mounds and craters. And so all sorts of different kinds of organisms loved to make their homes in all of the little crevices and grooves on this complex bottom surface. And we have this incredible diversity of organisms that were living at Brecon. And then periodically, we would have these massive hurricane-type storm events that would bring sediment from further out and just smother these communities right in place on the seafloor. So all of the organisms are essentially buried exactly where they were living.
So you've kind of got a fossil topography of what the seafloor was like all those millions of years ago.
The site has been called a Paleo Pompeii.
Wow.
Which I like.
And I've never heard of it. why haven't we heard of Brecon?
So it's been studied a little bit in the older literature, and then more recently it's received a lot more study, especially from Selena Cole and Davey Wright and their group working on some of the echinoderms from the area. So I guess you've probably not heard of it, just because a lot of the work that's been done on the site has been quite recent.
Okay, and what kinds of echinoderms can we find there?
So the most...
In general, what other organisms are found there, as well as morelomorphs and echinoderms?
So the most diverse group of echinoderms are the crinoids. So we have many, many different species of crinoids, and some of them could be quite huge. They can be like almost a meter tall, with stems that are maybe like 2 centimeters thick. We also have a great diversity of other sort of weirder echinoderms, like cystoids, and maybe other groups that are probably even less familiar to people. We also have some more familiar ones like starfish and brittle star relatives. And then in addition to the echinoderms, we have a great diversity of trilobites and also of things like bryozoans, brachiopods, and your typical mid-Paleozoic shelly fauna.
Yeah, was it expected then to find a Morellomorph within that kind of community of, you know, like a standard Paleozoic shelly fauna?
No, this was a complete shock to find this new Morellomorph in with this typical shelly fauna. I mean, we don't normally expect to get soft tissue preservation in the same sort of environments where these shelly fauna are living. So, I mean, we would have expected this to be sort of a well-oxygenated and well-circulated environment. And so we would think it would be difficult to get the sort of conditions that you need for soft tissues to be preserved. And yet here we have these examples. And so I think it's really exciting because it shows that there may be potential for soft tissue preservation in places that we might have not thought possible before.
Generally speaking, though, how well are the shelly fossils at Brecon preserved? And how well preserved was the Morellomorph? And was it, you know, a lot poorer preservation than the harder crinoids and whatnot?
So the hard shelly organisms at Brecon are incredibly well preserved. So the site has already been called a Lagerstätte just based on the exceptional preservation of these skeletal organisms, because we have essentially everything is articulated there. So all of these crinoids and other echinoderms have these really complex multi-part skeletons that typically tend to just disaggregate and fall into bits relatively soon after these organisms die. But this is not the case at Brecon. But then in terms of the preservation of the new Morellomorph itself, it's actually pretty darn good. We have elements of the body of the animal that have bits of the cuticle, so the outer exoskeleton still preserved, and you can even see these tiny pores that we think would have housed sensory hairs or sensory setae in them. And so the quality of preservation is actually better than we might expect for this sort of seemingly one-off find.
So trilobites have calcium carbonates in their exoskeletons. Were the Morellomorphs unmineralized, as in they had cuticles that were more like something like our fingernail, you know, flexible and not with minerals or metals or anything in them?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the reason why we only find Morellomorphs in sites that preserve the soft tissues of organisms. And it's also the reason why the new Morellomorph, Tomlinsonis, looks quite flattened, and it's essentially been reduced into this carbonaceous film. And that's in quite marked contrast to the mode of preservation that we see of the trilobites, where we still have these three-dimensional calcium carbonate exoskeletons preserved.
So you've mentioned your new genus is Tomlinsonis. Can you introduce it to us? What are its unique anatomical characteristics?
So Tomlinsonis looks a little bit like Morella. It's one of these Morellid Morellomorphs. And it has at least two pairs of these really long spines that are curved sort of like horns coming out from its head shield. And then on each one of those spines, on the front-facing and back-facing sides, we have these rows of these long finger-like extensions, these secondary spines. And we have about 20 to 30 spines on each face of those primary spines that sort of gives the animal this feathery look. And then the other thing that's really remarkable about Tomlinsonis is that while Morella has this pair of oar-like swimming appendages, Tomlinsonus has this ridiculously large pair of limbs on its head, which are very thick and robust, and they have these outward bending terminal ends, which sort of form like a foot-like structure at the terminal end.
How well preserved is Tomlinsonus, and do we know it completely?
So we know only a single specimen of Tomlinsonus so far, but that specimen is quite well preserved, and we actually see most of the body elements that we would want to see in order to diagnose this as a new species and to try and understand it in terms of its evolution and ecology. So we have, in this one specimen, remains of most of the head shield, as well as the head appendages, and we also have some of the appendages from the trunk region. And so really we're just missing the very posterior end of the animal and sort of what the trunk segments would have looked like dorsally.
It is a very nice specimen.
It's pretty surprising. I mean, you would expect it to be sort of scrappy given where it's coming from, but...
Mm.
So another thing to say is that the specimen is preserved a little bit like Burgess shale type fossils are typically preserved. And so that is, the fossil is flattened into this carbonaceous film, and then the split through the rock goes sort of irregularly through the organism, such that we have different body parts visible on the part and the counterparts slices of the rock. And so my supervisor, Jean-Bernard, was able to prepare both sides of the specimen so that we can see some of the different features on the part and the counterpart. And then we were able to digitally merge the part and the counterpart images so that we get a sense of what the whole organism looks like.
And where does Tomlinsonus fit within our understanding of the evolution of the Morellomorphs?
So Tomlinsonus is definitely one of the Morellid Morellomorphs. It has this characteristic spiny head shield, similar to Morella. And in terms of its relationship to other Morellids, we think it's actually closest to a species from the Devonian period from Germany called Mimetaster hexagonalis. And these two together are actually the youngest known Morellids. And so it sort of fits with our understanding of the stratigraphy, as well as with our understanding of the morphology of the organisms.
And so looking wider, what does the discovery of Tomlinsonus tell us about the early Paleozoic?
So I think the discovery of Tomlinsonus is really interesting because, like I mentioned before, we tend to have this very patchy picture of what soft-bodied organisms and soft-bodied biodiversity was like after the Cambrian period. So we have these amazing Cambrian Burgess shale type deposits, and then they sort of die out in the middle Paleozoic. And we have this much patchier picture of what actually happened to all of these these charismatic groups that were living in the Cambrian. And so I think the finding of these new Morellomorphs fits the general picture that we're starting to see when we're looking at more of these mid-Paleozoic Lagerstätten, where many of these charismatic organisms in the Cambrian didn't just die out, but they actually persisted for quite a long time afterwards. So this is a pattern that we're also seeing now with another group that is close to my heart, the Radiodonts, where we're also starting to see lots of examples in the Ordovician and even later popping up. And so I think findings like Tomlinsonus just give us that incentive to keep looking at old fossil sites and see what might be in there that we might have missed before.
Do you feel like there's a whole load more to discover with many of the groups that were around in these Burgess Shale type preservational settings, that we will find, you know, the vestiges, the lineages of in throughout the Paleozoic, if we're just looking in the right places?
Yeah, I think with the discovery of more mid-Paleozoic Lagerstätten, these sorts of discoveries seem to be happening again and again at an accelerating pace in the last couple of decades in particular. And I think you know, if there's one thing that we can always take away, it's that there's always so much more to be learned about these groups. Our fossil record is exceptional, but it's always patchy. And there's always a lot of puzzle pieces to fill in.
And looking at the Morellomorphs in particular, is there, you know, loads more to discover about those? What are the biggest questions hanging over them as a group?
Yeah, I think there's a ton of stuff that we don't know about Morellomorphs. And so for one, we only know about a dozen species scattered across 100 million years of their record. So I think it's pretty obvious that there must have been a lot more of them that we just haven't seen yet. In terms of really big questions about Morellomorphs, I think the one that's hanging over all of our heads is, where exactly do they fit among the different arthropod groups? Are they related to trilobites? Are they actually closer to the mandibulates or to the crustaceans? In our study, we found some support for the hypothesis that places them closer to things like trilobites and chelicerates. But I think it's still something that we need to do a lot more work on. And I'm hoping that some new fossil discoveries will shed a little bit of light on that in the future. We need some perfect transitional form, the tectalic of the Morellomorphs, right?
Yeah, let's hope so. So for people like me, who are often digging around in the Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, do you think that we need to be thinking about finding Morellomorphs when we're digging there? Do you think that, you know, that they could potentially be found if people are looking for them?
I absolutely think so. I think this specimen of Tomlinsonus was discovered by an amateur collector who we were collaborating with on this project named George Campouris. And so George has been collecting in the Brecon area for many years, focusing on the shelly organisms that are found there. But it was just complete luck, really, that he spotted this one obscure specimen with just the edge poking out, and was able to recognize its significance. And so I think now that we know that those things are in there, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see if more actually start popping out in places where we might have not expected to see them before. These fossils are really hard to see, and especially if you're looking for things like trilobites or crinoids, they're really subtle by comparison. And so I think it's maybe not surprising that we haven't seen these before, even if they are actually in there.
Okay, and so you said you've been volunteering since 2012. So that's not a very long time ago, and you've already seen, like, the description of so many new species from the Burgess Shale and around other Burgess Shale-type localities, the discovery of a Morellomorph in somewhere where we didn't expect. What do you think it'll be like at the end of your career? Do you think we'll have discovered amazing things that were completely unexpected? Or do you think it's just filling in little gaps here and there?
You know, at the beginning of my career, I would have naively said that we must just be filling in little gaps. You know, these Burgess Shale sites, for example, have been known for over 100 years. How could there be that much left to know? But in many ways, I feel like we're in a renaissance period in terms of understanding the Cambrian fossil record right now. There's just so much new information coming out from the Burgess Shale, from sites in China, from sites all over the world, really. And I think it would have been hard to predict many of the things that have happened in the recent years, even just a few years prior. And so I think we can expect to see a lot of surprises.
Yeah, good. And what advice would you give to anyone who's thinking of studying, researching Morellomorphs or any of the other early Paleozoic arthropods?
Well, I guess related to how many surprises that we've seen recently in terms of understanding early arthropod evolution, I guess I'd just say remain open-minded and don't be surprised if some new find completely changes our view on on how these things are related, how they were living, and their significance.
So if anyone is interested in seeing Tomlinsonus or other fossils that we've talked about, is it possible for them to do so?
Yes, so we're really excited that just in December, the Dawn of Life Gallery has just opened up at the Royal Ontario Museum. So it's a new permanent gallery. There's no rush to get there. It's going to be around for years. And so you'll be able to come and see Tomlinsonus, as well as many of the other fossils from the Breckenlagerstätte, and also a huge selection of stuff from the Burgess Shale. And I think it's a really beautiful exhibit with a lot of colorful reconstructions and animations that should be fun for everyone.
And what was your input into it?
Well, I got to help with some of the design of the models and stuff, and giving advice for the 3D prints and the animations. And that was pretty cool.
That's awesome. I would absolutely love to go back to the ROM. It's such a brilliant museum. Front of house and back of house in the collections. It's really remarkable. If anyone is going to Toronto, I can't recommend it enough.
You got to come for the Eurypterids.
And for the Eurypterids as well. Have they still got that giant, like, 6-7 foot pterygotid on the wall?
Yep, it's actually a big centerpiece in the new gallery, and they have a big bronze model of it, too.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I'd like to go and critique that. Yeah, I had such a wonderful time when I went there. I'll have to come back and see you all and hang out with Jean Bernard, and hopefully Dave Rudkin will make an appearance or something. Yeah.
Please do.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been brilliant.
Well, thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin-Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. But the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.